Good morning, Delaware. At least if you're still there, if you haven't like blown into Marion County or something, it's been quite a morning.
Oh my goodness. Yes, it was no one, except my husband, who might have a concussion. But no one else in my house slept last night.
I slept like a baby.
Yeah, my husband with a concussion slept like a baby. But
that's kind of scary, yeah. Well, Gage, you said you didn't sleep at all?
No, I didn't sleep at all.
Oh, that's terrible.
Like zero.
Oh, man.
Let's hope I don't screw up. But we'll
that's
see.
Gage tell us on the board, we hope.
Right?
And our guest today is Kirby Nielsen, who is a Delaware author who's written a book called American Genes, which we will talk about in the second half of the show. Really interesting and sort of scary book about a pseudoscientific trend from the last century. So we will be talking about that because its ramifications continue into the present. So Are you there, Kirby?
I am.
Well, great.
Thank you.
Welcome to the show. And thank you very much for writing this book. And I look forward to talking to you about it in a few minutes. But Nicole, what have you been reading or listening to or binging on this week?
Well, I have a bit of, I'm going to take us on a journey to get to the book that I want to talk about today. A few months ago, I discovered a woman on Instagram, and her Instagram handle is Sharon Says So. Sharon Says So. And her name is Sharon McMahon. She's an adult woman in Minnesota who was a former high school government teacher. And since COVID, she's found herself in furloughs and layoffs and things like that. Kind of went to Instagram, realized that there was a lot of questions in the world, you know, like what's happening with this? What does impeachment mean? How many years does a Congress person serve? Is Congress the House and the Senate? Just a lot of those kind of basic government questions. And so she just kind of found herself like, you know, starting every day with a question like, how can I help you? How can I help you today? And on Instagram, it was an open-ended question and people just flooded her. I mean, so her followers began, you know, with a couple thousand, and then and she would get, you know, tens of questions, then she would get hundreds of questions, then her following grew. I found her from a friend. That's how it happens, very organically like that. No paid ads or anything like that. I found her very organically through a friend, and that's how everybody else found her. And I watched her followers grow from when I found her at 100,000 followers to 250,000 followers to by the end of February, 500,000 followers.
Amazing.
And it was just by doing these simple questions, how can I help? And because she had that background as a high school government teacher, she answered it with facts. She is 100% based in facts. And the fun part about her is she will never tell you what party she is. She will never tell you her personal opinion. She will never tell you how she votes. She will only tell you the fact. So, you know, why is this happening? Well, here's the fact. You know, the fact is because this party says this. She talks about original sources, primary sources.
Yes.
She talks about, you know, going to the source, going to the actual press release, going to the actual speech, going to the actual Constitution, the documents. So if you have any interest in government, if you have questions about government, she does not belittle anyone by any means. If you constantly are asking, now, how many years does a senator serve? You know, she will always answer you just plain and simple with the fact, you know. And so she then has in her kind of growth of fame partnered with some other people. One that she has recommended is called The American Moms. And these are two twin women who have both served in different administrations. Okay. And one served as a press secretary. And I believe it was under the Bush more recent administration. And she had some recommendations. And she's been going through talking about famous first ladies.
Ah.
And one of the famous first ladies that she started talking about was Lucy Webb Hayes.
Ah, yes. Lemonade Lucy.
Yes. And so I didn't know much about Lucy Hayes. And I thought this had a, you know, relevant interest because, you know, this is the birthplace of Rutherford B. Hayes here in Delaware County. So, yeah, it talks about Lucy Hayes. She was born in 1877. And she kind of gives her a little bit of context, says, you know, if you thought Was
she
that
could
right?
not possibly have oh, no, 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 been born sorry. In 1877.
That's not when she was born. That was she was citing when Hayes served as president. Okay. I'm sorry. Yes, thank you.
I was facts. Like,
I read
facts,
I read
Nicole.
That in your and I read the fact in your face too. So yeah, so she talks about a little bit about what she's done, and she's giving context. Like everybody is always asking on Sharon's page, on Sharon Says So page. You know, has it always been this bad? Is America the worst it's ever been? And she will constantly say, no, it has been bad before this, and we have made it through it. The Civil War, you know, the American Revolution, all of these different things. Then she talks about, and when we went, go over to the American Moms page, she talks about the Hayes election. So she's saying, if you thought the last election was bad, the 1876 presidential election was actually the longest election process in our country's entire history. It dragged on for 4 months, and it wasn't resolved until just 2 days before inauguration. So basically, it tells the story of how Hayes was found to run against Ulysses S. Grant. Well, after his term, he had a whole bunch of, you know, scandals, and the people just really wanted to get like a squeaky clean person to run against the party. And so he ran against New York Governor Samuel Tilden, and it was so heated, it was called the last battle of the Civil War. He goes to bed thinking that he's totally lost, wakes up the next morning. He has lost the popular vote. This is all sounding very familiar, right? But there were states that were too close to call. And so with the states that were too close to call, they're still trying to figure out, like, how are we going to do this? And they put together a commission. The commission is made of seven Democrats and eight Republicans. And so then they kind of try and get it figured out. And then that 2 days before, they award it to Hayes. And it's just by one electoral vote. So yep. It's close. It's 4 months. It's one electoral vote. It's like, we've seen this before, right? So all of this is outlined in a book called Fraud of the Century, and that is by Roy Morris Jr. And if you're interested in it, I just looked in our catalog. We have one copy of this book in the DCDL, and it's available to check out. And we have like two other copies in the entire Central Library Consortium. So we might have to buy a couple copies.
We may have to.
Yeah, but it's Fraud of the Century, Roy Morris Jr. It's the Rutherford B. Hayes, Samuel Tilden, and the Stolen Election of 1876. So we went on a journey, but it really is really fascinating to see kind of that, you know, things of it goes around, it comes around.
What William Faulkner said, the past isn't dead, it isn't even past.
No.
So, okay, Mr. Nielsen, what have you been reading? I know we're not setting you up. We actually told you we might ask you this question. So.
Well, yes, I'm not surprised. You know, I'm reading something a little bit unusual and reaching toward the past. I found on my wife's bookshelf, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou.
Yes, yes.
I thought, why don't I just pick that up and start to read it? So that's what I'm reading right now. I think I'm probably about one-third of the way through it. And, you know, I can start to see already how brilliant of a writer she is, just in the way that she tells her story. You know, it's the story of her growing up and her early childhood. It's the story of poverty and racism, and you know, it's just kind of fascinating me. I'm kind of surprised finding myself reading it in a way. I don't know why I say that, but I'm enjoying it.
Isn't that great? That serendipity when you find something that you weren't expecting to find, and you get just enthralled in it immediately. A similar thing happened to me with the book I'm going to talk about. I was driving to work listening to the BBC on Sirius, and they were interviewing a guy with a really, really strong old-fashioned New York accent. And so I was listening to it, and the guy's name was Chick Donahue, and he was talking about a trip he had made when he was 26 years old. He was in the Merchant Marine. He was a Marine vet. He was hanging out in his neighborhood bar in Inwood, which is a neighborhood in the northern, very northern tip of Manhattan. And this bartender at Doc Fiddler's, which was the bar that he hung out in, said someone should take care of beer, take those kids in Vietnam a beer and let them know that we support them and we haven't forgotten them.
Oh.
And since Chick was in the National Maritime Union as an able seaman holding a card, He got elected to do it. Well, actually, he volunteered to do it. And I just found out that Navy actually stands for Never Again Volunteer Yourself. Anyway.
I feel like that's not official.
So he got a list of names for the kids from the old neighborhood who were serving in Vietnam, gets a job as an oiler on a munition ship heading for South Vietnam, and shows up with a case of New York City beers. And then he heads off to find his buddies. And the weirdest thing is, he does.
Aww.
He finds four of them while he's out there. Then he needs to get back to the States. He's already missed the ship he came in on. So he hangs around in South Vietnam while the U.S. Embassy takes its time trying to get him a passport because he's been traveling on his Merchant Mariner's card, but he can't get out of the country without a ship to do that. So he's hanging around. They finally hem and haw until the end of January. He finally gets all the papers he needs. He's about 12 hours from leaving. And then the Tet Offensive happens. And if you don't know the Vietnam War, the Tet Offensive was the major turning point in that war. It was the U.S. had thought they were winning the war. General Westmoreland, President Johnson, Defense Secretary McNamara were all talking about how it was just a matter of time. We're gonna have this thing over with. And all of a sudden, the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong staged this massive attack. Militarily, it was a disaster for them. But public relations-wise, it was huge. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, this thing isn't just a lark. He's cut off from everybody. The violence is incredible. Soldiers, civilians, spies, everybody's dying around him. And then the North Vietnamese Army in Saigon and Viet Cong basically cut Saigon off from all of their supplies. So through his contacts on other boats in the Saigon River, he finds a boat that's laden with food but can't unload it. So he finagles supplies for both locals and some of the reporters and others who are stuck in his hotel. This thing reads like an episode of MASH. But the weirdest thing is, it's a true story. The pictures of the men he brought the beer to, both in country and at a reunion that was held in the 2010s, provide the evidence. It's all there. Chick starts out as a really strong supporter of President Johnson, but the more time he spends in South Vietnam, the more he sees the bribery and the corruption, the more he questions the reasons for the fighting there. But he never, ever stops supporting the troops. Hmm. So this book is called The Greatest Beer Run Ever.
I love it.
I love that title. It's by Chick Donahue and J.T. Malloy. It was originally self-published in a very small print run in 2015, but then was republished in November of 2020, which is why he was being interviewed on the BBC. So why do I love this book? Well, Inwood could have been my neighborhood in Buffalo, the old First Ward. It was a tiny enclave of Irish and Italians in a big city dominated by work in and around the water, where life revolves around the Catholic Church and the Democratic Party, not necessarily in that order. I'm a generation younger than Chick, but I know all these guys, and it was just a delight to read this book. So anyway, I recommend it highly, called The Greatest Beer Run Ever. So
that's a great title.
It is. I love the title. So we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we'll talk to Kirby Nielsen about American jeans and an interesting period in American history. So stay tuned. Welcome back to Off the Shelf with George Needham and Nicole Fowles and Gage Tellis on the board. And our guest today is Kirby V. Nielsen, who lives here in Delaware, Ohio, where he writes novels and short stories. And his research and subject matter is eugenics in America from 1900 to 1970. Let's start with a really basic question. What do you mean by eugenics?
Eugenics is still or was a movement in which society decided that it wanted to improve itself, and to improve itself, it had to get rid of those people who had inferior genes. Mm. And this comes at a time primarily when people believed erroneously that behavior was caused by one gene. So there was a gene for alcoholism. Mm. There was a gene for a mental health problem. And so the way to solve these people from propagating and creating more people who would have bad genes was to do one of two things, basically to sterilize them or to put them in an institution. Mm. So that was the framework that eugenics was built around. It comes from actually the late 19th century. Charles Galton is the originator of the idea of eugenics, which means a better person or a better life forward. So we can get a better life by eliminating those bad genes among us.
So what were some of the frailties that eugenics was looking to drive out of the human race?
Epilepsy,
mm-hmm.
mental health issues such as depression.
Right.
Developmental what we know as developmental disabilities today, physical handicaps, people who had stuttering, perhaps. We're talking about anybody that was perceived to have a weakness, and a weakness that might require society to step in and take care of that person.
Wow!
So this is what these were some of the things that went into the judgment. That these people were inferior. And so that's really kind of what I wanted to shed light on with the book, that this time led to hundreds of thousands of people being institutionalized, for example.
So
eugenics was just part of a bigger framework, actually. When I study it closer, it's a part of racism. It's a part of the American, I'm just kind of at a loss for a word here, but the American uniqueness, immigration restrictions, all of these kinds of movements were designed to keep the white person in power. And eugenics did that to a certain extent.
Yeah, Kirby, I'm interested. This is really fascinating. How did you find yourself, you know, researching this topic? What's your background?
My background, I'm a psychologist by training.
Okay.
And at a certain time, 1975, I met a woman. and I knew her just briefly. And she was perceived to have been one of these people who was, quote unquote, defective. She had been in an institution, in fact, for 41 years.
Wow.
She had completely normal intelligence. She spoke just fine. There was not anything wrong with her. We looked back in her history, and they thought perhaps that she had epilepsy. She was committed to the state of, this happened in Minnesota, to the state of Minnesota indefinitely, an indefinite commitment, because they thought she had epilepsy. And I stress the word they thought, because she never had epilepsy.
Good
That's
Lord.
How I got interested in that subject. When I came across a disability in 2008, I thought, boy, I have to redirect my own efforts toward what can I do? And I thought of that woman, and I thought, I can learn to write. So I've been on a journey for over 10 years now to write this story. And there's another story that goes with it. So this is just actually the first of two books.
Oh, that's exciting.
The second one is sent to the publisher already.
Oh, great. I was going to ask you about the sequel, because you do imply at the end that there's a sequel, so I'm glad that's coming up. But I just want to get back to this one, because there's some really interesting characters in this book. Anna, who is the young woman who is committed, goes through, I mean, she has a single seizure, and this social worker who is on a mission to get everybody who isn't exactly like her, basically. I kept thinking when I was reading this was she should be played by Margaret Hamilton, like Elmira Gulch in The Wizard of Oz. But then she's just absolutely, totally dedicated to this concept of racial purity. Quotes favorably from Mein Kampf at one point in the book. They're so interesting. Anna's family, her father and mother, who are immigrants and have made this successful farm, but then things kind of go south on that. It's just a fascinating set of characters. But what drove the social worker, whose name in the book is Joan Breidenbach, what do you think would drive a person like that to be what she was?
I think Joan was a committed eugenicist. She admired the Nazi Party, and this was at the time when the Nazi Party came into view, because she thought the Nazi Party did this eugenics right. If early on in the book you hear there's a scene with her father, and she's kind of committed her life to pleasing her father, who's long gone by this time, just keeping this idea of purity going, racial purity. You could think of her actually as an American Nazi. She was just totally committed to that. You're right, George. That's a very good observation. That's just exactly who she was.
Well,
and ahead.
She wasn't alone in this, though. When you look back and you read about eugenics, I mean, there were some well-known people who were giving patronage to this idea. Alexander Graham Bell, yeah. Luther Burbank, Margaret Sanger, Theodore Roosevelt, W.E.B. Du Bois. Mm-hmm. People who were respected in many other fields were actually strong proponents of this idea.
Correct, yes.
And please go ahead. I'm sorry.
It was widely accepted. Eugenics, pure families, the best family in the county. There were county fairs. There were contests to see who had the best family, the purest family. Many of us recall in our childhood, perhaps some of us who are a little bit older, you know, how this idea of a person who wasn't right, quote unquote, was kind of kept in the off to the side, or maybe just stayed at home with grandma the whole time. There was shame if you had somebody in your family tree that had some sort of a disability, and this really stuck with our society for a long time. Mm-hmm. We've just become to accept people who are different from us, people who have a developmental disability or an emotional problem.
What do you think changed the cultural zeitgeist so that we got away from? Was it the terrible destruction of the Nazi Party that kind of made us rethink this, or was it something else in our society that changed?
There were a couple of things. Certainly the revelations of how far the Nazis took this concept was number one. Mm-hmm. But number two, there was a change in the Kennedy era. Both Bobby and John F. Kennedy began to tour institutions and began to see how horrible they had become. And that was one of the things that began to turn the idea that we need to find a better way to help people. We shouldn't be locking them away if they're different from us.
Of course, they had a sister who had been locked away.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So they began to introduce legislation that allowed for funding of more community services. And there were many other people who were instrumental, but those would be the two names that most people know were really instrumental in beginning to change the public view of this.
So tell us a little bit about the sequel in the last minute or so that we've got. And then I'm going to tell you, we're going to ask you back when that sequel's published because we want to know more about what happens to Anna. But but just give us a little bit of a taste of what we're going to see in the sequel.
And when.
And the when, sequel, yes.
the sequel, well, you know, I sent it to the editor and they're strangely quiet. I haven't heard back from the editor yet. What bothers me is he's taken a long time reading it. No, I'm just kidding. It's a story about how Anna survives the next 41 years of her life. So the sequel will pick up where this book ends. I won't give the final chapter to people who might still want to read the book.
Right.
But it's about 41 years of surviving 41 years in an institution. It's a focus on how bad the institutions were. Mm-hmm. So in the same spirit as this one, it conveys the message, this is not the right way to do things.
Just a little peek you give us in the first book here of what those institutions were like in the 20s is enough to just make your blood run cold.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And when I saw some of those things that I wrote about, my blood did run cold. And it was... these things were awful. I saw some of those things.
Wow.
Still, and I'm, it wasn't all that long ago.
Right, yeah.
No.
50 years ago?
No, it's within our lifetimes.
Within a lifetime, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Within our lifetimes, yes.
So do you have a title?
We have much to be thankful.
A working title for the second?
The working title for the second one is Isolated in America. And I stress the word working title. It's very appropriate here because this publisher didn't like the title I had for the last book, and he came up with American Genes. I forget what my title was, but we talked about that, and he said, no, it's not going to be that. It's going to be this. So
we'll call it a compromise.
I'm hoping we're staying with the American theme, and we're going to call it Isolated in America.
Right.
That sounds great.
In that location.
Well, thank you for being here.
Look forward to it.
Yes. And we are going to be processing your books and adding them to the collection very shortly, so you'll be able to get them from the library. So we really appreciate your gift.
We'll have them.
Okay,
well, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to visit about it because it's something that's very, very important to me.
It is wonderful.
Well, it's an important topic, and I'm glad we were able to have you on. So we got about 30 seconds here. What do you got for this week? Anything big that you want to mention that's happening in the library this week?
Well, if you haven't tuned in to any of our Wednesday story times that happen at 10 o'clock on our Facebook page, Delaware Library, you should this Wednesday because it is a virtual story time with Miss Lori. And it is all about firefighters. And she brings in a guest firefighter who is, I believe, a niece of hers. And so it's really wonderful to see a fire lady at the helm of the story time with Miss Lori. So I would tune in for that.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So great. All right. Well, thank you very much. Again, thank you, Kirby, for being here with us today. We've really enjoyed talking to you. And we're looking forward to seeing the sequel as well. Gage, you managed to make it through the show.
I did.
I hope you make it through City Digest, too.
I got to make it through the whole workday, actually.
Well, yeah, but you're only live for the next half hour.
Oh, that is true.
And Nicole, thank you very much. And, of course, thanks to our friends in the library. I'm going to be meeting with the president of the Friends in about half an hour back at the ranch. So thank you all for listening, and we will see you in the stacks.